Today is December 5th, 2016, and I'm here with Susie Wall in Detroit, Michigan. Could I have you state and spell your name, please?
Yes, my name's Susan Wall, and actually it's Susan Marie Bobricki Wall, because it's my married name, but I'm no longer married Wall. It's S-U-S-A-N, Susan Wall, W-A-H-L.
Perfect. Okay. So first question, where did you grow up?
I grew up on the southwest side of Detroit, around Livernois, Michigan, in a Polish enclave, and behind a Polish grocery store that belonged to my grandparents, where they raised 10 kids because the house and the store were connected. And there was something else I wanted to tell you about that. Major thing. My father was alcoholic, so at age three, my mother realized my father couldn't hold down a job. So she asked her parents if she could take on the store, and she did. So she ran the Polish grocery store meat market, where we made our own sausage, and that's how she supported us, you know, through our lifetime. And not the whole lifetime, but the good part of my childhood. And I helped a lot there. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the background. But here's a picture of the store.
Oh, wow.
When my grandparents ran it. And here are my grandparents.
Aww.
And then
that's very sweet.
A picture of the store after it closed.
Oh, cool.
It was called Bobricki's Market because my mother took my father's name, of course. Before that, it was Slowick. And you can see we had groceries and meats. So we made, you know, we ground hamburger, mm-hmm. or we cut pork chops. We made, in fact, my grandparents made their own lunch meats, too.
Oh, wow. Is it still there today at all?
And we would all, because I have 35 cousins, would all visit regularly, mm-hmm. You know, at least go around it. My cousin owned it for a while. My cousin Billy took it over because no one wanted to see it leave the family, but it burned about, several years ago, and everyone was going to get one or two bricks or something from it as a memento, but it's so sad that it's not there because I thought it would always be there.
Yeah. Where did you go to school?
I went to school. My grade school education was at St. Stephen's Catholic School, which was about 5 blocks away from our house. It was a walk, and I'd come home for lunch every day because I missed my mother. And I went to high school at Girls Catholic Central, which was an all-girls Catholic school down here. It's now the St. Pat's Senior Center. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they didn't tear it down. It's a great old building. And I went to St. Pat's Church up until, I think, a year or two ago when they closed it.
Wow.
And I was devastated that they closed it. But I just have this feeling it's going to reopen, because it's right in the heart of Midtown. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous to close it.
Right.
But anyway, so my sister went, my older sister, who's 2 years older, and I have a younger sister, 8 years younger. There were the three of us. I'm the middle child. My older sister, I did whatever she did, because I really didn't have a mind of my own. And so she went, she started at Wayne, she became a teacher, and I thought, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and so I just kind of followed in her footsteps and became a teacher also. And then she went on and got several other degrees, one in counseling and another one maybe in sociology, and I got my bachelor's. My major was speech, my minor was English, and my master's in education. Because, the education thing, that's a long story. So I'll wait for a question on that one later.
But. At Wayne State you did?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And how did you originally get involved with Cafe Detroit?
Well, let's see. How did this happen? And I know this story so
If you want to start with kind of post-college, your journey, that's fine, too.
Actually, once I got my degree, I got a job teaching in my old grade school, St. Stephen's.
That's cool.
Well, that wasn't my first job. Actually, my first was at St. Casimir's. Then I moved over to St. Stephen's, and the pay at that time was like $7,000 a year. It was really, really poor. And I was at St. Stephen's then for 2 years teaching, and it was kind of neat because it was where I went to grade school. But the area had changed a lot. Well, it's changed even more since, but it was mostly Hispanic children and some Polish kids, but a lot of the people had participated in the white flight out of Detroit.
Gotcha.
And so anyway, I taught there, and I also got married to Jerry Wall, and well, there's a long story on that. I don't know if I should go into that part of it, but my mother's health was not so good, but she still had the store. And so the second year I was teaching at St. Stephen's, she got very ill. But at the same time, my husband asked me for a divorce. I still don't know why. When I see him, I'm going to ask him because I really don't understand what happened. But when he kept bringing it up, I thought, well, you know, he said this once. He said, I want to live the life of a single person again. And I thought, is he kidding? And then 6 months later, he said it again.
Oh, no.
And I thought, okay, he really means this. And I thought, well, I don't want somebody who doesn't want me. That's fine. Let's get the divorce. And my mother died at the same time. So all these, it was horrible. It was so devastating because the three of us girls were so close with my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother's death was much more devastating than my divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I thought, I really don't want to teach. I don't think I really wanted to teach in the first place. I want to open a business like my mother because I worked alongside her hard for a lot of years. And so my ex-husband, who I was still on great speaking terms with and am today, he said, I have a friend who wants to go into business too. He says, I'll introduce you if you're interested. And I said, sure. So this guy, and he also looked a lot like my husband, and I have some photos.
What's his name?
Greg Borner. And B-O-E-R-N-E-R, Borner.
Mm-hmm.
And so Greg talked to me, and he was interested in purchasing the Tartar House, which was on Palmer between Cass and Woodward.
Okay.
And it was just a small dive. But it was pretty popular because it would get the street traffic. And things were different around there at that time. There were not as many Wayne State buildings. There were other small businesses. So I was game for it. It didn't take much. I said, sure, yeah, let's do it. So my mother had left each child $7,000. So from her insurance policy, which wasn't much, but I ended up buying my home, putting a down payment on it because homes were cheap back then down here on Peterborough between Cass and Woodward. And I thought I put that picture in here, but maybe I didn't. And also putting a down payment on the restaurant. So we started the restaurant. We kept the people who were there because the cook was a great cook. People loved her cooking. And I think it's here.
And what year was this?
This was in 1977. And so we kind of kept everything the same at that time because we really didn't have a lot of money to do any renovating. But then, and this was our, these are pictures of the opening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Greg. That's myself. But really, we were not involved, you know, only in the restaurant. But he had lots of girlfriends.
Uh-oh.
So anyway, we started working in it, running it, and I jumped right in. I mean, I had no problem. In fact, I had two other waitressing jobs, one at this business, like a businessman's lunch thing on, it was called Bonaparte's, and we had to wear leotards.
Oh, no.
And the lighting was low, and it was just open for a few hours, but you could make some pretty good tips. And so I met this girl down here, Laura McGuire, and she worked as a waitress. And so she told me about that place. She says, come on and, you know, I'll get you a job there. And she did. So, and then I also worked at Porter Street downtown. Well, she did too. We both applied there. And so I did both of those, Bonaparte's by day, Porter Street at night, and my restaurant in between. It was insane.
That's crazy.
But it was insane, but we were insane. And so let's see. Then that was 1977. So we ran it for a while, and I mean, we did everything. We cooked. The cook taught us how to cook. And each one of us took a week to actually be back there with her. So we were making breakfast because we were open for breakfast, and then we'd close about, oh, I don't know, maybe 8. I can't remember the original hours, but there was no liquor served.
Right.
But then we took on another partner. It was a friend of Greg's, Tim Parvin. And so when Tim came in, he was bringing a nice influx of money so that we could renovate and get a liquor license.
Okay.
So we did in 1979, and here's pictures of the renovations. We really did it up. We bought, Wayne State used to have like secondhand stores and resale places where you could buy, I mean, beautiful antiques for almost nothing. And so we bought all the wood. We bought cabinetry that we could cut down the middle. It served as our back bar, and I'll show you that in a minute. So we put all this heavy duty oak all over the place, and we had the front window etched with our logo, which, and I named it the Cafe Detroit.
It's an awesome logo.
Because I was saying Detroit Cafe, Cafe Detroit. And then we were all trying to come up with names, but everybody liked that one, so we kept it. And
and it began mainly as just a restaurant, and then it turned into
Got the liquor license that we bought, I think, from the business that was right across the street where the new student center is. And that didn't seem to be much of a problem, you know, at that time. But there were only so many liquor licenses. It may still be that way today. So we got the liquor license, and here's the back bar, which was really a fireplace.
Oh, wow.
A mantle. And then, but the people helping us do the work were very, very good carpenters, but friends. So the price of doing it wasn't that outrageous, and we were helping with a lot of the work. And then we had our mirrors etched, you know, and like I said, we had the logo on the front. It was pretty gorgeous. Oh, and we had the old marble bar, which was the bar that became famous overnight because I guess Harry Truman stopped there. And I can't remember exactly. I'm thinking it was on 3rd and something, but we got the marble bar. So
from a different restaurant?
From the old marble bar.
Oh.
Yeah. And so we had the marble bar inside of our place, and we would share that story with everybody. Then we also built an outdoor patio, and we thought, why not? We had all the space in back, so we bricked it. We did the work ourselves, and that was a big hit. In fact, once we started to, we also did some cooking out there. And this is a Lowell Boileau, who's a famous Detroit artist. He did a painting of the outdoor cafe. Actually, there were a lot of those done.
It's beautiful.
It's time for another picture. Yes, it is. This is Barbara Green, is a famous artist from Detroit.
Wow.
Everybody knew Barbara Green. And she actually lived at my house for a while. But her stuff, people just loved it. And she would come and do paintings and drawings, well, drawings that she would paint later mm-hmm. of the musicians, and she had tons and tons and tons of them. And this is her take on the back bar.
Amazing.
And yeah, it was pretty cool. And right now she has cancer. She's in Toronto, and she had just, I guess she just wrote a cancer book. She's wild and crazy. I mean, she is really crazy. And I think she got her lung cancer really from all the fumes, from all the paints. And so I'm hoping that she's going to be able to win mm-hmm. this battle, because they're finding more cures for lung cancer.
So after you guys, you kind of merged into nighttime type right. activities.
Yeah.
How did that go over originally?
Oh, that went over really well. And people started coming in asking if they could be part of the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, I don't know how I, but I'm sure happy I did all of this. I loved booking the entertainment. And then there were people coming asking if they could put their art up on the walls,
wow.
and people asking if they could organize poetry readings. And when people asked if it sounded halfway decent to me,
mm-hmm.
then we were on. You know, we were going to go for it, and we did. And everything just turned out just famously. I don't think Elvin's even had their... they didn't have their liquor license yet or their cabaret permit yet. And I remember we were kind of picking brains, you know.
Gotcha.
And they came to pick my brain. But it was really, just listening to the community talk to you. And they told you what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, it's my belief that if you follow up on that, you're going to be successful. And it was real easy to comply with it. I mean, the hard part was the money.
Right.
But, you know, that kind of worked itself out for a while. So here we have the Outdoor Cafe. At one time, 32 trombones played there from Wayne State, because I approached Wayne State, and I can't remember the last director's name. He died not that long ago, not that many years ago. I just can't think of it. I'm too bad I didn't write these things down. But I said, can we do something with the jazz lab band?
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked something out, and he loved it, because they could be exposed to, you know,
right.
people could be exposed to them. So, and then there were also private parties in the back, and we had some pretty handsome staff, male and female. And then I also did... I decided I wanted to do this Halloween party where there was the most neurotic, psychotic, exotic, I can't remember the last one, costume contest.
That's amazing.
And now I'm seeing that repeated all the time. And actually, it was the French maid who won.
And what year did you kind of transition into the night after you did the renovation?
In 1979, we started that. And and then there were also people coming who worked at other venues,
mm-hmm.
like the Circa. She was the bartender for years at the Circa.
Oh, wow.
And her husband worked at, he was the cook at Lully's, the chef, I should say. And they came in. It was their place to hang out. So there were a lot of people hanging out there. And a lot of the local people, you know, because there were the daily people who
mm-hmm.
would come in for lunch. But and that was pretty crowded. But in the evening, you really got to know people.
So you did stay open for lunch and breakfast and
oh,
stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Like
we were open at 7 in the morning until 2 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
And at one point, it was like 7 days a week. And we also did Sunday. We had live classical music with the New York Times. And the DIA does brunch with Bach. Yeah, or they used to. And I forget. Ours was something like that, but it was... I don't know if it was breakfast and Beethoven. I forget what name we gave it. And this is just one of the... This is probably several parties, because I see people... My sister... Here's my sister, Eileen.
Aww.
My best friend, my sister. She's also the cook at the Circa right now.
Oh, wow.
She's been there like 35 years.
That's amazing.
I swear, she's been there forever. They called her because they knew she was honest, because they were right around the corner from us.
Mm-hmm.
And we all knew them. I mean, when your restaurant's in close proximity, you borrow from each
right.
other. You know, we need buns. do you have any hamburgers? You know, and then you pay back. And
right.
do you have quarters? We need rolls of quarters, you know, or whatever. So anyway, those are some of the parties. And we were also at the same time doing entertainment. And I have my sister found this online. This isn't all of our entertainment. It's just, I can't get the rest of it. I don't know how this got on there either. I have to investigate a little bit. But this is what, 80 and 81, I think? 80. And part of 81 and then 82. But we really had much more than
mm-hmm.
this. But these might be the ones that they kind of sanction, whoever this website is. And they look like, when I'm looking at the names, these are probably the better known jazz groups in Detroit, because we kind of settled on the jazz eventually.
I was going to ask you that.
That's what happened.
How did that happen? How did you choose jazz?
Well, in the beginning, we did a little bit of everything. Like we did, they were way out there, you know, the Inside Outside Band with Mary Roberts and Ralph Korsiarski, and he can play any style music.
Mm-hmm.
He's a horn player. They did some wild things where they'd be squirming on the floor, and the place was packed. I mean, people really followed them. And so we did a lot of that in the beginning. I don't know if this one goes into Inside Outside. Don Tappert and the Second Avenue Band, and I think that was more rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing that, but then someone said, I said, we really need somebody for our actual opening party. And a friend that was coming in, a regular, said, you know, Frank Isola, this really famous jazz drummer, he played with Mose Ellison, Jerry Mulligan, all these big names. He lives with Jack Corcoran right around the corner in Brown Park. So they said, go over, he's over there, go talk to him. So I did, and he was jazz. And so we became very, very good friends. And he died several years ago, and I had put together, because we were having a tribute to him, all these people wanted to have a tribute to him. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I had a whole series of articles,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't include because I thought, well, we don't want to just focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
But he really had a reputation, and he was just excellent. So here are some shots of him.
So once he kind of came on board as one of your good friends and started playing there, you kind of centered in on jazz?
Well, people started coming out of the woodwork asking if they could play there, and I started to really get into the
mm-hmm.
jazz, and I loved it. And so that's basically what we did after that. We just really focused, unless somebody might come up out of the blue and ask, and maybe they did something different.
Mm-hmm.
But Elvin's was really doing it, that's because they finally got their liquor license and their cabaret license. And they're just down the block, and they were doing more of the rock and roll, because a lot of the guys who worked there were also musicians.
Okay.
And then we kind of focused on the jazz.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of just evolved. And so all of these guys, Ken Kellett, I can't think of their names right now. He died recently. But they played with Frank, Lamont Hamilton, Ron Jackson, all these groups. And so I'd book them,
mm-hmm.
Gave them a pretty decent wage. Stan Booker, piano player. These people had great reputations. I mean, I had to learn about them because I really didn't know, but I'm glad I did. And Chloe Martin, Chris Peterson, who's a good friend, and Marcus, who just died. Oh, and I'm so sorry. I was sick at the time because I missed the funeral, mm-hmm. any memorials to him. He was wonderful. He was just great. We really became good friends.
And what years did this kind of, like the evolution to jazz, what year did that kind of start happening?
That probably happened, 79 is when we got our cabaret. I would say, and looking back, I could probably see that. I think it was like 80. It could have been 79, though. And, you know, some of these papers actually didn't have a date on them. I couldn't believe it. I thought, you don't have a date on here? So going to straight jazz, I would say maybe late 79, maybe early 80.
Okay.
Early 80s. And
did most people, because you kind of said that you went to Frank, but then you also said some people came to you. So how did you normally book people?
Oh, I booked people by the month. It was pretty much, wait, was it by the month? Let's see how that went.
So one person would play for the entire month?
No.
Okay.
Maybe not. Let me check that out. The art shows were by the month because you didn't want people. This one does say every Thursday, Marcus Belgrave. Insane. Okay, now here's 81, so maybe things were more stable. Oh, no, every week it might be a different person.
Okay.
Right, okay, because May 1st and 2nd, inside, outside. May, I can't even read that.
That's all right. So usually we'd go
every week
a couple days
a
during the week, and then every week
and
we
were doing music like almost 7 days a week.
Wow.
Yeah, and
was it mainly people approaching you, or did you go out and seek them out?
You know what? They were all coming in and asking. And once they saw that Frank Izzola was there, mm-hmm. and he had such a stellar reputation, people were coming just, I mean it, out of the woodwork. And wonderful people. So much fun, so easy to deal with. But I did pay a little bit better than other places because they told me that, you know? and I treated them with a lot of respect because they certainly deserved it. And I mean, the place would get packed. We finally started doing a cover too because my partners did tell me, you know, we gotta make more money to be doing this music this often. So I got chastised a few times, but a lot of the musicians, singers, artists would also come and work for me because they need a job.
Oh,
and
wow.
I figured, well, give it a shot. If it doesn't work, I'll just tell them it's not working out. And then, like I said, people were coming in to put their artwork, you know, on the walls, and that would be on a monthly basis. And this guy, what was his name? Bob McEwen. He took photos of a lot of really well-known musicians, probably downtown at Montrose. So then he did a show where he had all the photographs up, and the stuff was for sale, and it sold pretty well, too. And I didn't take a commission. You know, if they had a, I'd say, if you have a small piece that you wouldn't mind giving up, but otherwise I wouldn't take a commission because I just didn't want to do that. But you can see some of the artwork on the walls.
Oh, wow.
And it would, like I said, it would change monthly. And with the artists, I really had to look at their work. I didn't say, because many of them I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to look at the work. And if this is pretty subjective, but if it appealed to me, I said, sure, you know.
Yeah.
And so we had a guy who did T-shirts, and the author who wrote On the Road, I can't think of it.
Jack Kerouac?
Jack Kerouac's wife was in town.
Wow.
And she came and she bought a ton of the T-shirts that were up there. The guy was so happy. You know, it was great. It was great. It really, Wynton Marsalis was underage, and he snuck in because he played with I think his father's a musician and his brother also, and he would and when he played at Montreux later when he was a little bit older, someone was interviewing him,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about how he snuck into the Cafe Detroit.
Oh my gosh!
And would sit in. He'd sit in, you know. And I mean, mm-hmm. you were supposed to be of a certain age if you were coming in for, but you know, we let him in, and Hugh Masekela and a few other people who signed our book. Wow. People would come into town because they'd hear about the cafe and the music that was... It was really the great, well-known jazz musicians like Marcus and Frank Isola, and those names would just draw, you know, all kinds of people. So that was a plus. And let's see, these are a lot of our regulars. I'm trying to see where...
Who are some of the most famous people who came in? I know you mentioned a few.
That would have been Wynton Marsalis, Jack Kerouac's wife, I'm trying to think.
Anyone who played there, like as a headliner type person?
Yeah, Al Hibbler.
Okay.
And I can't remember the name of the song that he wrote and played, but he was a blind musician, and I called him... And I don't even know who gave me the lead, but I called him. He was coming to town. He knew where he wanted to stay. My friend and myself picked him up, and we transported him, and mm-hmm. he played at the cafe. And I also tried to get Betty Carter, but because she played at Baker's, she felt like she could not, kind of break that trust and play somewhere else. So, and I understood that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say... Probably, and then Marcus played with, you know, some of the greats. I mean, he had such a reputation. Mm-hmm. He really wasn't from here, although he said he was from here because he spent most of his life here.
Right. What was his full
Ray
name?
Ray Charles is Marcus Belgrave. He played with Ray Charles Band for years, and many other people, lots of Motown people, and I don't know if you know Marcus Belgrave.
I know the name.
Oh, yeah. He was, and what a great guy. I know I have a million pictures. They're all falling
out. No, I love them.
But here he is. He'd bring his kids in and have lunch, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these people who came at night started coming during the day also.
So it's just a popular hangout spot.
Yeah, it was like a family, you know. It really was a family. And there he is.
Who are some of the more difficult people to work with? Is there anyone that gave you a hard time?
You know what? I really can't think of anyone.
That's probably a good sign.
Yeah, that really is a good sign. Because I would say it was mostly a wait staff. But that's typical. I know, because mm-hmm. I waited tables too. And then we were getting press. Herb Boyd, who wrote quite a bit, and I think he's still alive, he wrote, I love this article he did on me, because he really gave the place applause, you know, and it really made me feel good. And let's see. Oh, this is just a sample of somebody's poetry, yeah. But this is during the poetry readings that were going on. So, and people did plays. There was a fashion show.
Wow.
And whatever, if people, the wilder their idea, the more I liked it, you know. And these things would go over so well, you could hardly walk into the place. Rodriguez used to come in all the time. Rodriguez, who... no one knew he was alive, but then in South Africa, there was the documentary on him, you know, that mm-hmm. that guy did, and then he committed suicide after that. Mm. Not Rodriguez, but the guy who did the documentary.
Yeah.
But I met Rodriguez at the laundromat, and he was showing me his platinum albums. He had them in the back of his car. He said, come on, I want to show you. And so I walked over and looked, but he still did not know what fame he had and how people were crazy about him. Now, you used to see him walking up and down the street all the time, and I never heard him play. I think I may have asked him to play at the cafe, and he would play with his back to the audience. He was very, very shy. Gotcha. I think this whole, this fame, I think it was really difficult for him. I think if I talked to him, he would agree that it was, that it is. But now he's like touring constantly. So
awesome.
He's getting his fame late in life.
Go.
It's kind of interesting. But and then there are just other articles here on Frank, on the cafe. I just brought it along.
Mm-hmm.
And there's strength at the end. But I also have, someone even wrote a song about
cafe.
So people did really love it, and they still talk about it to this day.
What was Frank's role? Did he just play there a lot, or did he kind of help you book people?
Frank Isola?
Yes.
Well, actually, he and I were dating. We began dating even though he was a lot older than myself. But no, he didn't do that. He kind of rested on his laurels, so to speak, you know.
But he did play.
Oh, yeah, there. He played everywhere, really. I mean, he was not just at my place. In fact, afterwards, after my place closed in 77 to 84, he was playing downtown in all kinds of venues, just absolutely everywhere. I'm sure he was at Baker's, too. But they would... all these musicians participated in the Montreux Jazz Festival.
Okay.
And that's how I would kind of stay in touch with them. But a few came to visit me when I was recovering from my cancer, and it was so great to see them. So I'm going to have to get back in touch with them, because we really had close ties with
them. So who was the easiest to work with, would you say?
Easiest.
Who you kind of developed the best relationships with?
Oh, I would have to say, well, it was most people, but especially people like Marcus, who was the most positive people are always the best to work with, because even if things aren't great, you never know it. I mean, they're not the complainers. They kind of roll with the punches.
Right. So Marcus.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, for sure.
What are some of the other, you said there were a lot of crazy different kinds of bookings you did there. What were some of those?
Well,
you said a fashion
like
show.
Like I was saying, the fashion show, and something of it, the fashion show I think was called Calla Lily. And then there was also a play that someone put on. And then, like I said, the t-shirt show, the 32 trombones on the back patio. That was in the afternoon on a Sunday. We did Sunday morning classical brunch, and then we did jazz on a Sunday afternoon.
Wow.
And that the place would pack. It was great having the sun streaming in and jazz playing.
Yeah.
And people loved it. So those were some of the more bizarre things. And then, of course, the inside-outside band with the squirming on the floor in between people's legs under the tables.
My.
It was bizarre, but people just loved it. They ate it up. So, in fact, you saw that flyer, didn't you, of them?
Yeah. And what kind of people normally came in?
Oh,
was it everybody?
God, everybody, you can imagine. Everybody, people who lived close by. We got a lot of law students, a lot of social workers, because the Cone Building right across the street, a lot of social work classes, sociology classes were held there. And so they were coming through. And then, of course, once people came for the entertainment, they, you know, kind of... they felt comfortable there, and they just started coming back regularly. But the local people, local artists, local musicians, you know, the poets and all of those people, because they knew that they were welcome, you know.
Right. And you said it only lasted till 84. What happened?
Right. Well, we realized when the economy got bad in the 80s, and it really got bad, one of my partners wanted out, Greg Borner. So Tim and I bought Greg out. And Tim really had to take another job, because we weren't really taking any money. We just couldn't, you know. And maybe some of the things that I did, some of my decisions might have taken, you know, taken money away from the business. I don't regret that I did them, though. But anyway, then at one point, so Tim was a steward for the airlines, and so that's how he made his extra money. And at one point, he said, you know, this won't sustain both of us. He said, I think it would sustain one of us, but not both of us. He said, so what are we going to do? Do you want to buy me out, or am I going to buy you out, or... what will we do? Because the economy was even getting worse, and people weren't coming out. I mean, people were still coming up, but they didn't have that extra money to spend.
Just come for the entertainment versus
even the lunchtime crowd, which was always a big crowd, you could see it was there, but it was not like it was when the economy was good. And so I decided I loved the cafe. I was so invested with it emotionally, you know. I said, I'll buy you out. And I was only 27, and I wasn't very savvy money-wise. So when I told them, I'll buy you out, I paid him everything. It's not like I paid him monthly amounts.
What year was this?
This was in 84. 80. Maybe it was 83. And I was pretty broke then.
Wow.
And I remember Barney Surowitz from Alvin's, who bought Alvin's from the original Alvin, who had quite a reputation and eventually went to San Francisco. Barney Surowitz said, Susie, he was always giving me advice. He says, whatever you do, he says, pay the government first. He says, you have to pay them first. He says, you can make other people wait, but they must be paid first. Well, I didn't do it that way. I paid my employees first because they were closest to me and they worked the hardest. I paid the musicians, the vendors, I paid all them first, and then there was never any money for the government. And so eventually, and I could have bargained with them, but I wasn't sophisticated enough to know what I was capable of doing. I didn't have an attorney. I grew up in a poor family. When you grow up richer, wealthier, these things, they kind of, you get them through osmosis, you know, that knowledge. And so I, when they said, you know, you're gonna have to find a buyer, I did that. Instead of fighting with them over it, I didn't even know I could, to tell you the truth. And so
you were young.
I found a buyer for it. And then the proceeds from the sale were supposed to go to pay the back taxes. But the people who bought it didn't pay the back taxes. So when I quit, well, when I sold the cafe, I really did. I didn't get any money for it. So I started working downtown. After a brief hiatus, I got a job downtown. Somebody told me about Skipper's, and so I went. My friend worked there, and he introduced me to Skipper, and I became Skipper's bartender for a few years.
That was a restaurant?
It was a bar that served food, but not maybe hot dogs, chips. You know, I mean, really, they did not have a kitchen. But it was very popular, especially amongst the Canadian kids, and it would just get jammed. And so a lot of the music that was at the cafe, Frank played there. A lot of these same people came over and played at Skipper's. So it was like a lot of my former life moved with me to Skipper's, and Skipper was very open to it. It was great. Only he was much more savvy, and he only did it once in a while. And so I worked for him. He really liked the way I bartended, because I could work hard and also not steal. And, you know, you have to worry about people. And but eventually, I met a guy there who I fell in love with, and he said, you have a teaching degree? You should be using that. And so I kind of thought about it. You know, I said, maybe you're right. So I went back into teaching, but this time I got certified for, well, they put me in an elementary position. I went to work for Detroit Public Schools because they paid much better. And then someone said, well, you know, if you're going to go back to school and get recertified, get your master's, because all these classes will count towards your master's. So I did that. And I taught first grade for 20 years at Spain Elementary School, and I loved it every minute of it. But at one point, the government was garnishing my paychecks. And it was because of money owed that was never... And you know what? I should have been on top of it, but I thought when the deal was done and an attorney represented me and the buyers, and I said, isn't this a conflict of interest? You represent... And he was a local attorney. I'm not going to use his name. But I was really later, I think, I thought, how could you do this to me? You know, and these guys, they took everything down that we built inside, all this beautiful oak, and they made it the McDonald's of the Cass Corridor, because someone called it that.
What did it be? Said, was it still called Cafe Detroit then?
No, now it's, it was called...
So they did change the name and everything?
Yeah, they did. They did change the name. It's now it's Biblos something or other. But, oh, God, I can't think of it.
That's all right.
I just saw it.
But it wasn't a jazz club anymore or anything?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. They were still serving alcohol because they got the liquor. Oh, no. Actually, the Cass Cafe has my liquor license.
Oh,
so
that's cool.
They must have brought in their own liquor license, somehow got their own liquor license in there. But, yeah, the Barrache brothers, I'll say their name. Because that was such a big disappointment. And they've had other restaurants since, you know. But really, they were more into the cooking portion of it,
right,
and
the
really
restaurant.
Not into the entertainment portion. And I was going to say that, so I called the IRS and I said to them, when does the statute of limitation end on this? And that was back when they could really abuse you,
right?
You know, and the agent I talked to was very abusive, and she said, you have no right. This is something you should pay, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I just need an answer. And she had to give me an answer. And so she told me it would be like another month or so. And I was so thankful because I really felt like that was not money I owed anymore. But the whole thing should have been handled differently, much differently. But anyway, so I was really happy teaching at Spain Elementary. I loved it. I never would have quit, but I was diagnosed with cancer. And then I had to, because I had to undergo radiation and chemo and all of that. So my life has changed. And then once the cancer was gone, as it is right now, you know, hopefully, but my doctor said you can never really say that it could come back. So I just thank God for every day I have. But then I thought, well, now I can do what I've always wanted to do. I have my old 1890s house on Peterborough. Mm-hmm. And all the time I was teaching, I was so involved in the teaching. I think my cancer may have been a product of that. But I decided I was going to finally renovate my home the way I should have. And I wanted to get my sister to come back and live there with her boyfriend and possibly even my other sister. So I want to do separate living quarters for all of us. And so I'm pretty much ready to go this spring.
Awesome.
I have people coming in. But then I find out in February that they're going to, three young men are building shipping container, five restaurants and two bars, 10 feet away from me, right next door. And I will say this name, Sue Mosey from Midtown is the one who directed them there. And this was a, before the houses were knocked down one by one, there was not an empty lot on the block. It was definitely residential. And now in fact, it's been spot zoned, which is illegal, but nobody would listen to anything I said. I went in front of the council. I did my research. I went in front of the committees. I said, this feels like a slap in the face, because I never would, people said, get out of Detroit, Susie, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. I stayed through thick and thin, and I said, I will never leave Detroit. I love it. I love my home. One day I'll be able to retire there and really bring it to its full glory, you know, and I said, it feels like you people are slapping me in the face. And they listened to me for a moment, but then the deal went down. You know, the deal's going to go through. The bottom line is money. And I found that out, and that was a rude awakening. We fought, several of us, this past whole summer was taken up with that. And I did not want to fight, but I went in there fighting. I had to get it together because I wanted to finally relax, you know, and forget it. So now I'm on a mission.
Kind of a little back to Cafe Detroit in the last few minutes. How do you think it contributed to Detroit and its local musicians? Because jazz is such a big part of Detroit.
Oh, I think that those local musicians, not only did they have income coming in from it at a time when there wasn't a lot of work for them, because they would tell me these things, so I know this to be true. And it also kept the jazz alive, you know, and people could find places where they could hear live jazz. So it was a real blessing all the way around, you know, and it was great for the legacy of Cafe Detroit, you know, that they were, that we were so involved in it.
Why do you think so many talented musicians come out of Detroit?
I think it's the town. It's a struggling city. And I think you see a lot, and not just musicians, but artists, people in general, you know, blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, people work hard. They're big givers, too. Detroit always has had a reputation as a big donor city, a very charitable city. So I think it's those things that really bring out the best in people sometimes.
Yeah. What do you think the most gratifying part of owning Cafe Detroit was for you personally?
I think it was seeing all these people being able to express themselves artistically, and I think it really meant a lot to them. The artists of that time that put their work on my walls, I'm going to have to go and see it. It's part of Wayne State's collection that they're going to put up at Smiley Brothers. It's not called Smiley Brothers anymore, but it's the it has a name, and you know the building
I'm speaking of.
It's between Ferry and I think it's Ferry and Palmer on Woodward. It's a huge mansion, and attorneys were there, but then Wayne State got it, and then I read this article when I was looking for an architect to come and look at my house so I could get historic designation, because that was taken away from me by Sue Mosey. And I found that out later on when I talked to some people. So she must have had designs on that block a long time ago. But anyway, and I could go into a lot of detail on that. But the work of these people, Brian Tillman being one of them, but so many of them, Stephen Goodfellow, Loa Boileau, Barbara Green, so many of these people, some were already known when they put their stuff up, but some were not known, but they're part of the Detroit Corridor Artist movement, you know, and, you know, when I saw what this one, this man and his wife, they're very wealthy people, they amassed a collection of these works, I thought, maybe they bought them at the cafe, because you could get these things for a good price.
Probably.
If they were somewhere else, they were, you know, if they were up at MOCAD or something, it's gonna, the price is going to be jacked up.
So, do you have any final exciting stories? Something that sticks out in your head?
About the cafe?
Yeah.
I think I told you most of them. Like when,
a particularly
when these
fun
people
night.
Came in, but I have to think for a moment.
That's all right.
Well, actually, after the cafe, like in its heyday, mm-hmm. when all the musicians were playing, especially like on a weekend, let's say a Saturday, and this might be before we were doing the Sunday music. Uh-huh. So maybe Sundays we were closed then, but we were still doing the Saturday. I would just invite everybody back over to my house, and we would just party all night long. And I was younger then, so I could stand it. Now it doesn't take much, and I'm done. But those were just great times. I mean, I really made friends with people. That's it awesome. Wasn't just a employer-employee kind of thing. It was more than that, which made it harder to work sometimes, but it was, that was very gratifying, because when I see these people now, I mean, we're like, even though we haven't seen each other in many years, it's like we're all deep down friends. Mm-hmm. You know,
are you still involved in the music scene in Detroit at all?
Just really listening, and I haven't been out that much. Mm-hmm. But I would like to go to Montreux again. I would like to reconnect with these people wherever they're playing. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be a great thing to do. But I'm just really getting my feet wet, because I had this struggle
right.
since February. And then I finally just had to give it up. I did. I gave it up because I wasn't winning. And I thought, I'm not giving up my house.
No. Nope.
I'm going to live here. But it would be nice to reconnect. So I've reconnected with a few old friends, and it's time-consuming. It's like, how am I going to break myself up to do all these different things and work on my house at the same time?
Right.
So, but I'm going to do it by the grace of God, because I've strengthened my faith. I mean, God has strengthened my faith, but to the ultimate level. So I'm really happy about that. Because I don't know how I did it before without him. But I was given 6 months to live.
Oh, wow.
And because I asked, and they said, you should have been dead by now. And they said, we don't know what it is. I said, I do.
Aw. Are you still close with, I know you said that you haven't kept in contact with a lot of the same people, but are you still close with any of them today?
Well, what's happened is I never got on Facebook, and teachers were telling me, that's the way you do it. Get uh-huh. on Facebook, then everybody can know your condition, how you are, what's going on. And I just got on Facebook a few months ago, and my cousin was the one who did that for me. And I'm still learning. I don't even know how to do certain things on there. And so I'm still learning. But through Facebook, people are contacting me, and it's really been great.
And reconnecting.
Oh, yeah.
Like who?
Well, for one, Laura McGuire, my old friend that I worked. She worked at my place, but we also waitressed together mm-hmm. at Bonaparte's on Porter Street. She and I, it's like we didn't lose a day. Mm. We didn't lose a beat. And we almost went to Noel night together, but we both had things to do. So we're going to, the guy who owns Alvin's, who used to own Alvin's, Barney, is mm-hmm. having a party on the 17th of December, way out. I don't know if he's in Algonac or where he's at, but she asked me to go. And she said, think about it. I said, I thought about it. I'm going.
Aww.
You know, because I want to see these people.
Yeah.
And then Anna Kroll is another one. We were good friends. And she's friends with Laura also. And so we'll have to connect. And I know I'll see other people if I start going out to these venues.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Sharp married, God, I can't think of his name, but he did all the famous posters during the 70s and 80s. God, why can't I think of his name? That's terrible that I can't think of it. But
what kind of posters?
All like for the MC5, he did, what was his name? Well, he died not that long ago. And so Laura Sharp is like, I heard that his funeral was something else. I think they were dancing around the coffin.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I mean, it was really wild and crazy. Gary Grimshaw. It a very well-known poster artist for all over the country, not just mm-hmm. in Detroit. I think he even may have done a Beatles poster. I mean, he really was quite the guy, and a really nice guy. And she knows a lot of people. I'd love to see her again, you know. So wherever she would be, I'd probably run into a bunch of people. So, and my sister works, she's, like I said, the night cook at the Circa. And some of the Cafe Detroit people have continued on at the Circa.
You know?
I mean, in terms of a place to go, it's become their bar. So occasionally I'll go in there and run into a bunch of people who used to come into the cafe.
Regulars and stuff like that.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people moved out. I stayed, and a lot of people moved out, but there are still people down here, Carol Baker and her husband, Mike, and they're kind of movers and shakers down here. And, oh, Joel Landy, who's doing... the Scott Mansion on Peterborough, he's renovating it. And I mean, that place looked like it could never be. But he takes on big projects, goes in front of the city, gets the approval. And he's even helped me during this whole fight that I had. You know, he was great. And I knew he was busy, but he would say, Susie, anytime you need me. And what a great guy he is. He's been responsible for so many things going on here well before the city decided to turn things around, you know.
Well, that ends our time. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I'm glad you asked me questions, because I really